Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, November 10th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Northern California Coalition to Safeguard Communities warns about dangers for workers on illicit grows during cold weather months. Green Cemetery Project gets humble permitting. And a robbery suspect apprehended in Eureka. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
As trimming season kicks into high gear and nights grow longer and colder, the danger of carbon monoxide poisoning due to improper heating setups on illicit farms grows. The Northern California Coalition to Safeguard Communities, NorCal Coalition, sent a release reminding community members of the dangers of working in unsafe conditions with improper heating can cause real damage and even cost lives. The NorCal Coalition is a nonprofit organization that works with law enforcement in Humboldt, Lake, Mendocino, Trinity, and Siskiyou counties to combat human trafficking and organized crime in Northern California. KMUD News spoke with Summer Hansen, public information officer for the NorCal Coalition, for more information about what they do.
The NorCal Coalition was put together because trafficking in rural Northern California, especially on the cannabis grows, has become such an issue, and it's been going on for years and years. So the sheriff's offices, five of them, and a district attorney, as well as some victim services and environmental scientists, all sat down together and decided to finally do something about it. So they figured if they put all their resources together, they'd be able to make a huge difference. And that's exactly where the coalition came about. And what we do is we investigate illicit cannabis operations in those five counties, which are Humboldt, Lake, Trinity, Siskiyou, and Mendocino. We also identify human trafficking happening on those grows, as well as environmental crime. And if we do identify trafficking, we have the ability to extract those victims, connect them with services, hold those traffickers accountable, and then also prosecute any environmental crimes that have been going on, such as illegal pesticide use, water diversion, all that.
Human trafficking in Northern California has long been an issue on illegal grows, with victims being forced to stay on the grows and work under poor conditions. Hansen elaborates more on the cross-section between illegal grows and human trafficking concerns.
A lot of people find it hard to believe that it's actually happening, but these illegal cannabis grows are often controlled by organized crime networks from other places. They've came here to use these remote sites to launder their money, hide any other transnational criminal activity that they're doing, and during the process, they're exploiting labor and they're trafficking people on the illicit grows that they are putting out in the middle of nowhere. And so there's ways that these traffickers have been able to make contact with these victims. The way that they do it is they either contact people online or via phone. They have contact with people from other countries or relatives of people who are already here, contact their relatives from back home. We've seen posts online where they advertise a beautiful summer working in the rural hills of Humboldt County. They put these on websites in Europe and other countries in order to try and traffic people over here. They promise them work. We've even seen people who have visited other labor locations in California, such as like the produce farms, and they promise them good work, good money. We've seen people help. They promise to help people get over the border in exchange for, you know, a good, better life. They just have to work to pay their way over. But then what happens is they take them somewhere totally different than what they originally promised. Then they take their phones, they confiscate their belongings, and they force them to work on this grow. So from there, it overlaps into even more trafficking, because from there, the victims can get passed around to other trafficking operations where they can be exploited, you know, sexually or in a whole different industry other than cannabis.
According to a report from the Los Angeles Times, they documented more than a dozen deaths of growers and workers from carbon monoxide poisoning. This happens when a gas stove that's been used for warmth is left on in a sealed tent or greenhouse and has caused several deaths on illicit grows.
Some major risks and the reason why this recent release came out, several workers have actually died in Northern California on these grows due to the severe risks. Like makeshift housing, no heat, no insulation. They don't have running water or sanitation. If they do have a heat source, it's typically like a propane or a gas stove or heater that, you know, the traffickers provide them to maybe make some food. They end up using that as their heat source. They put it in their closed structure, and that's where a lot of these carbon dioxide deaths have been happening. It's from these victims just trying to stay warm because the conditions, you know, the weather conditions out in these rural areas can get really, really hot, but they can also get really, really cold. And with this recent storm, you know, we've been having freezing temperatures, and it wouldn't be surprising if some of these victims have been using their propane stoves for warmth. That's just one of the risks. A lot of them, like I said, they're not really from this area, so they're not prepared for the cold. And they're already exhausted from being overworked, so they face the risk of hypothermia.
When these grows are reported to the NorCal Coalition, they work with law enforcement, district attorneys, and investigators to report the illegal activity and offer support services to trafficking victims present. They also have lawyers if victims wish to press charges or need a trafficking visa. Hansen explains more on how the coalition helps victims in these circumstances.
If a community member or a victim submits a report to the coalition, the first thing that happens is we pass that information along to whichever corresponding sheriff's office, whichever county the report came from or the report is in. From there, they are able to start an investigation. With the information provided, they can identify suspects based on the location or pictures or license plate, anything like that. Once they identify a suspect, they can serve a search warrant. They can actually go to the operation, serve a search warrant, get on scene and identify any potential victims that could be there. One really interesting thing about the coalition, since we are backed by the sheriff's office, is if we identify a victim on scene, we are able to offer them the option to leave with us right then and there. So we can extract them, get them into our custody, and from there we can hook them up with our victim services, which is another portion of the coalition. Once victim services has them and has stepped in, they are able to provide them with housing. They can get the victim medical assistance if needed, food. They can even help them with legal assistance. So if that victim does want to go to trial and, you know, go against their trafficker, we totally support them throughout that entire process, and we encourage it to hold these traffickers accountable. There's even the option of a trafficking visa, because a lot of these people are coming from other countries, you know, and back home it might not be any better than the conditions here. So our victim services can help them go after getting a trafficking visa. And while this whole investigation is going off of this tip that someone submitted, our environmental partners are going over the evidence that they were able to identify when they were on scene during the search warrant. And so they look into illegal pesticide use, water diversion, things like that, so they can determine what chemicals are where and who's at risk, you know, nearby and all that.
Some signs to look out for when identifying possible trafficking victim presence or illegal grow work exploitation include people living or sleeping in greenhouses, vehicles, or sheds without proper heat, running water, or bathrooms, workers looking cold, exhausted, and not properly dressed for weather, individuals who appear stuck on site, unable to speak freely, or unsure of where they are, and more.
There's two types of people that can be aware. There's the people who are living in these rural areas where illicit cannabis growth has been found and travel on these rural roads frequently. And then there's also just members of the community. You're in the more populated cities like Eureka, Fortuna. The first thing that we want to make very clear is that you do not need to intervene yourself in these situations. So if you do see any of the signs that I'm about to tell you, don't make yourself a part of it. Stay distant, you know, take notes, take photos, vehicle descriptions, license plates, even coordinates can help us a lot. But just for your safety, just stay away from the situation. So if you are one of the rural community members and you're traveling these roads, things that you can look for are makeshift shelters that are near hoop houses or barns or large structures. You can look out for individuals who might be transported to remote driveways or unmarked roads. If you do a daily commute, let's say on Highway 36, and you notice suspicious vehicles making a turn down a really unmarked rough road kind of frequently, maybe you could take a picture of their license plate and report that as a tip to the coalition. If you come upon any people, individuals who seem cold, obviously with this weather going on, or obviously unprepared for the cold weather, so their clothing might not look right for the conditions, they're wearing the same clothing, and if they look exhausted or worn out, those are all indicators that you can look for. And especially if you notice bright lighting or generator noise that's happening at night in these remote locations, even if the grow looks like it has been shut down or closed for the season, indoor grows happen all year round. So if you notice any of that happening throughout the night, you can try and get us a general location for us to be able to investigate that.
The release also notes that if in the position to do so, taking a photo or writing down vehicle information or physical descriptions can go a long way.
Yes, this has been happening for years and years. The labor exploitation has been happening on these illicit cannabis grows for a long time. Another thing that is commonly misconstrued is that the industry has dried up and that this isn't happening anymore. That is false. It's just more hidden now. That might mean that since it's hidden, the conditions are even worse now that we are unable to get to it as easy as before. Another thing that we want to make clear is that the legal regulated growers are actually a part of the solution. So if you support the good guys, we can go after the bad guys. So if you support the legal licensed cultivators, you're reducing the market for illicit operations. And that's kind of what we're going for. Another thing that we want the public to know is that the coalition is a nonprofit. So we're privately funded, and we do have a tip line, which is completely anonymous. Each person, whether you're a neighbor, if you're hiking, you're driving down a rural road, you can be a part of preventing this harm. And all it takes is staying alert, caring about what you see, and reporting your concerns to the coalition. So how you report it, we do have an anonymous tip line, like I mentioned. It's 707-441-3031. And you can also visit our website, NorCalCoalition.org, or visit our social media pages. We're on Facebook and Instagram. And we are encouraging the public to kind of follow along, follow us on social media, keep up with our website so that you could really educate yourself and become helpful in this situation and help us help these people who have no other way out.
To report an anonymous tip to NorCal Coalition, the number is 707-441-3031, or the website is NorCalCoalition.org. Green burial is a growing movement with about 20 green cemeteries in the U.S., and soon there will be another one in Humboldt County. Daniel Mintz reports.
A green cemetery project that seeks to allow the dead to, quote, return to the earth gently in harmony with the land has been approved by Humboldt County's Planning Commission. The operations plan of Sacred Groves Incorporated, the nonprofit permit applicant, also describes green cemeteries as living sanctuaries, demonstrating, quote, a shift in how we think about death, memory, and our place in nature. A conditional use permit for the Sacred Groves Conservation Green Burial Cemetery was approved at the commission's November 6th meeting. Located on Neyland Road in the Neyland area, Sacred Groves will encompass 47 acres with a maximum burial density of 120 graves per acre. Sacred Groves Executive Director Michael Furness explained green burial's basic aspects and the standards that will be followed.
It involves interring an unembalmed body in a simple biodegradable shroud or casket. The body is placed in a relatively shallow grave, 3 or 4 feet deep, with no concrete vault or plastic liner so as to promote aerobic decomposition. So simply, no embalming, only biodegradable materials, and no concrete vault or plastic liners. So further, we've gone with the conservation burial best practices and certification process. And we are seeking that, and it is very strict standards for how we operate, extensive and rigorous best practices, and we intend to do restoration work with funds set aside for additional conservation efforts.
The cemetery site is currently used for hay production, grazing, and forestry. Those uses will continue, with some of the hay field converted to oak savanna forest. Sacred Groves will offer 3 burial options: forest land burial, grassland burial, and burial in the Oak Savannah Restoration Area. Furness said 492 mostly local people have, quote, signed up and are following our progress. Enthusiastic support for Sacred Groves was voiced during a public comment period. McKinleyville resident Jennifer Wheeler, a botanist and environmental scientist, described green burial as part of a natural cycle.
After the end of my lifetime, I'd like to return to the essential elements from which I was formed inside my mother's womb, as she absorbed nourishment from the soil, plants, and beasts of our planet. I don't want my last contributing act on this earth, if at all possible, to be adding to more human-caused pollution. No cremation carbon emissions, no forever garbage in or on the ground, no plastic flowers, no polyester flags. I want my children and grandchildren to come visit my final resting place in the most natural place possible, and in doing so, offer them a place to find communion, perspective, and beauty in an increasingly disordered world. In that way, I can continue to be a mother for them and play a small ecological role for soil organisms, plants, and wildlife.
Rick Littlefield, owner of Eureka Natural Foods, said green burial, quote, seems like such a natural kind of an approach to end of life with some dignity, and we don't have that choice right now. And Rebecca Stauffer, a member of Sacred Grove's board of directors, said green burial is, quote, the cleanest, greenest, and really most beautiful way to bury our loved ones, and is, quote, so Humboldt County. The conditional use permit is necessary due to the site's zoning, but written public comments have been largely supportive. Some commissioners raised public health and safety concerns, questioning whether burials will be deep enough to prevent animal disruptions. That was discussed in this exchange between Commissioner Thomas Mulder and Furness.
I've seen bears dig up things, and I read in your report that you may bury bodies as shallow as 18 inches, so God forbid something happens and a body is dug up. What is the protocol? Because I don't believe I read that in your report.
Yeah, we will have a protocol for that. It isn't in place yet, but the probability of that is near zero. These animals didn't evolve with food being at that depth. The statutory burial requirement, that's 18 inches of soil on top of the burial. And that's plenty for a smell barrier, and there's just no incidents recorded whatsoever. And I've polled many people across the country. Does this happen? It doesn't happen.
A written staff report says there's, quote, no evidence that the project will be detrimental to public health, convenience, safety, and welfare. And a minimum burial cover depth of 18 inches was ultimately deemed to be adequate. Commissioner's approval of the permit was unanimous. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Last Friday, on November 7th, at approximately 9:48 p.m., Eureka police officers responded to a report of a strong arm robbery. The victim stated that while riding in a car with Ryan Taylor Lindowski, 41, he had pulled her hair and robbed her. KMUD News spoke with Laura Montagna, public information officer for the Eureka Police Department, for more information on the incident.
On November 7th, 2025, at approximately 9:48 p.m., Eureka Police Department officers were dispatched to the 600 block of G Street for a report of a strong-arm robbery. The reporting party slash victim stated while riding in a vehicle operated by Ryan Taylor Landowski, age 41 of Eureka, he pulled her hair and forced her to provide him her ATM card. Landowski refused to allow the victim out of the vehicle and drove to an ATM. Landowski removed money from the victim's account, and while doing so, the victim was able to escape and phoned EPD for assistance. The victim provided officers with a description of Landowski's vehicle. EPD officers began patrolling an area of town where they knew Landowski frequented and located his vehicle traveling on Highland Avenue. An enforcement stop was conducted by officers, and Landowski was detained without incident and subsequently identified by the victim. During a search of Landowski's person, incident to his arrest, officers located the money stolen from the victim's account. Landowski was transported and booked at the Humboldt County Correctional Facility on charges of kidnapping to commit robbery and robbery.
EPD asks that if you have any information on this incident, to contact their Criminal Investigations Unit at 707-441-4300. In state news, California food banks see surge as federal shutdown continues. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Food banks across California are seeing a big surge in demand and are tapping emergency supplies as the government shutdown continues. The shutdown threatens future funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is distributed through CalFresh in the Golden State. Debbie Espinosa is CEO of Find Food Bank in Indio.
We have moved into emergency disaster response mode because the scale of the disaster is going to be equivalent to COVID. All of our sites have grown over 30% on average.
CalFresh was able to pay out full benefits for November late Thursday, but funding is uncertain going forward. Although a judge ordered the U.S. Department of Agriculture to tap emergency funds to pay full benefits on Friday, the Trump administration immediately appealed the decision to the Supreme Court, pausing the order. The shutdown persists as Democrats push to extend health care subsidies, something Republicans refuse to discuss until the government is reopened. Espinosa says many food banks were already seeing a surge in food insecurity because of the administration's wave of immigration deportations and mass layoffs at federal agencies.
We've got federal employees here that are hurting as well. So we're layering the SNAP effect on top of the government shutdown effect with the federal employees. So we were already seeing a spike.
California receives more than $1 billion a month in federal funding for CalFresh. More than 5 million Californians depend on the program, including almost 2 million children. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Republicans reject Schumer plan to reopen government, extend ACA subsidies for 1 year. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history entered day 38 Friday, with still no real talks to reopen government. In the Senate, there is at least some talk about talking, but Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson seemed to shut the door to negotiations with Democrats Thursday.
There is really nothing for us to negotiate.
He wants the Democrats to just vote on the Republican stopgap spending bill passed by the House. Johnson was responding to a proposal by Republican Senate leader John Thune, who offered a vote on extending Affordable Care Act tax credits, the main sticking point for Democrats. Johnson shut down that idea, too.
I'm not promising anybody anything. I'm going to let this process play out.
On Friday, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer made a new offer to reopen government. His proposal is to extend the health care tax credits for 1 year and reopen government. And then, after government reopens, have longer-term negotiations on health care costs.
Let's do all three. I've spoken with my caucus, and Democrats are offering a very simple compromise. Democrats are ready to clear the way to quickly pass a government funding bill that includes health care affordability. Leader Thune just needs to add a clean 1 year extension of the ACA tax credits to the CR so that we can immediately address rising health care costs. That's not a negotiation, it's an extension of current law, something we do all the time around here.
He says the proposal would reopen government, families shopping for health care would get the tax credit, and Republicans get their way on not starting negotiations until government reopens.
Now, the ball is in the Republicans' court. We need Republicans to just say yes.
But Republicans said no. Senate Leader Thune called the proposal a non-starter, and other Republicans lined up in opposition. They're considering a plan to get around Democrats by eliminating the filibuster. That would let Republicans pass their plan with a simple majority instead of needing Democratic votes for a supermajority. That plan has been called the nuclear proposal, and President Donald Trump, who recently ordered the resumption of actual nuclear weapons tests, backs that plan.
The way to do it for the Republicans is to terminate the filibuster. They call it the nuclear option. This is the second form of nuclear. Very good, very good. This is a good form. This is not a bad form.
He seems to be looking at it as a form of preemptive strike against Democrats.
The Democrats will do this, so if the Democrats are going to do it, I'm saying Republicans should do it before they get a chance. It's very simple. And if we do it, we will never lose the midterms and we will never lose the general election because we will have produced so many different things for our people, for the country, that it would be impossible to lose an election.
Meanwhile, the shutdown drags on. Travelers are scrambling as airlines cut flights because of the shutdown, and flights are being cut at 40 major airports, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago. And President Trump is asking the Supreme Court to intervene after an appeals court upheld two court orders requiring the administration to distribute full SNAP food aid benefits. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, Canadians will pause for Remembrance Day to honor those in the military who died serving their country, as well as those still serving. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, special ceremonies over the weekend honored Indigenous members of Canada's military.
It's Indigenous Veterans Day and has been commemorated since 1994. Indigenous members of Canada's military shared their stories at ceremonies across the country. In Ottawa, Defense Minister David McGuinty had this message for them.
Throughout our history, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis members have served with exceptional bravery and distinction in the Canadian Armed Forces. They have fought, endured, and sacrificed in our name. From Vimy to Dieppe, from Korea to Afghanistan, Indigenous service members have demonstrated extraordinary skill, courage, and devotion to duty.
Indigenous Veterans Day came about because many of those veterans were not given the same benefits as their non-Indigenous peers. Ray Deer is the president of Quebec's only First Nations-operated Canadian Legion. He says people need to know about the contributions made by Indigenous members of the military.
I think by joining the military, it gives us a voice. It gives us a voice that can be heard amongst the Canadians and the Americans because they know we served alongside them. Without doing that, without serving alongside them, you're more than invisible. We're invisible as it is, but we'd be worse off if we didn't participate.
Other Indigenous veterans say they gained respect from military colleagues for their character and their ability as soldiers. But some say the camaraderie vanished when the fighting was over and there was a return to Canada. The federal government says more than 4,000 Indigenous people served in the military in the First World War and 3,000 served in the Second World War. Recently, the government acknowledged the unfair treatment of Indigenous soldiers, where many thought their rights and standing would improve when they returned home. But as efforts towards reconciliation gained momentum in recent years, there was more effort to recognize Indigenous veterans and their contributions. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A tribal school district in northeast Wisconsin says the government shutdown has impacted federal funding it relies on for salaries, supplies, and student programming. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
The Menominee Indian School District is one of about 20 school districts in Wisconsin that receive impact aid funding. The program provides support for public schools on federal lands. Superintendent Marcus Denny says their district has limited access to local tax dollars due to a small taxable land base, so program funds cover about 40% of their budget, but payments haven't gone out because of the government shutdown.
So that's impacted our budget big time. We've had to move around a lot of funds from our general fund. We had to seek a line of credit with our bank to help meet operational needs. It's impacted us heavily.
The district serves about 1,000 students, and Denny says many of them come from high poverty backgrounds. He says food assistance cuts due to the government shutdown are also having a broader community impact, as many students don't have adequate access to food at home. Denny notes community organizations and the tribal government are working together to support local families by stocking food pantries and soliciting donations to send home with students. Denny says the Impact Aid Office has been in frequent communication with districts throughout the government shutdown and has informed them that payments will be processed once operations resume, despite concerns about resources becoming increasingly scarce should the shutdown continue. Denny says he has confidence in his community.
The Menominee people and Indigenous people in general are very resilient, and we've faced challenges for years with the government, and this is just another bump in the road for us, and we just continue to do what's best for our kids and our community.
I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.